Welcome to Hope Beyond the Badge, a podcast that brings awareness, inspiration, and conversation together for first responders, families, and others interested in mental well-being and first response. New episodes weekly with your hosts, Jay Bailey and Linda Kokoros. Jay is a father, a military veteran, worked in the fire service for 18 years, and carries a diagnosis of PTSD. Linda is a mom, a wife, a certified life coach for first responders, and a suicide loss survivor of a first responder. Let's talk about it. Our guest on the podcast today is Rob Swartz. Rob is the state director here in Massachusetts for the Struggle Well program. Rob also spent 35 years as a police officer. During his law enforcement career, Rob was a key participant in the creation of the SEMLEC Peer Support Critical Incident Stress Management Team. Rob has worked with state legislators to create and implement statewide peer support confidentiality laws, mandatory training requirements, funding for peer support teams statewide, and sits on the National Fraternal Order of Police Wellness Committee. Throughout his career in law enforcement, Rob has been involved in countless critical incidents and is personally familiar with the impacts of trauma and struggle on first responders and their families. Rob, welcome to the podcast. We want to thank you so much for joining us here today. We're looking forward to hearing about your career and about all the work that you, Boulder Crest, and Struggle Well are doing to sort of cultivate wellness in the first responder world and community. First, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to our audience.
Sure. First, thank you for having me. This is the last place in the world I ever expected I would be to do a podcast about this. So we'll start with that. Rob Swartz, as you said, I started as a police officer very young. I was in college, did an internship, and I was a summer cop down the Cape for a while. Went to a drug task force in a local agency, worked there on and off through my career as a part of an internship. Got put on an agency, worked there for a year, and then went to the Taunton Police Department, where I spent a majority of my career, and most of that career time was spent as a canine handler. Once my last dog was getting ready to retire, I retired him, and then went into their detective unit, where I spent the last, I think it was almost 5 or 6 years or so, I think, before I retired in October 22, when I aged out, I guess I should say, meaning I hit my 55, not my 65.
Wow, that's a long career, right? 35 years? In law enforcement?
I didn't look at it that way until now that it's over and you look back and realize it was.
Wow, 35 years.
During the time, I never looked at it that way.
So, Rob, let's get into that. Like, share us about your family. Do you have family, kids, wife?
Yes, I do. I have a 20-year-old son, a 24-year-old daughter, and I've been married since 96.
Wow.
Terrible in math, so we'll just leave it at that. I'm good at math to figure it out.
It's 29 years, maybe.
There
right?
we go, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself going back to that career, right? Because I know we're here, we're going to talk about Boulder Crest, we're going to talk about Struggle Well, something that you're very involved in. But before that, let's take us on that journey. Like, what made you want to be a police officer?
It's funny you ask, because that's something that gets asked often, and I honestly don't remember. I do remember it's something I always wanted to do, even as a kid. I binge-watched Hill Street Blues as a kid, for those of us that may be a little older and remember that program.
Yeah.
And ever since then, it's kind of the only thing I ever wanted to do. I can't think back to anything else that I wanted to do. So the first opportunity I got, I jumped right in.
Good for you. So what was it like as a young police officer? Do you remember that? Do you remember, like, your first day or your first, you know, couple of months on the job? It was down the Cape, right?
Yeah, it was down the Cape. I started at one agency where all I was doing was traffic control unarmed, so that lasted about 2 days. And then I actually transferred to another agency where I worked patrolling the beaches during the weekdays and then the downtown on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And then my second summer there, I was on overnights, which most times with a, you know, a senior full-time officer, and sometimes they would partner up two part-timers. Mm. And towards the end of it, you'd be out there by yourself.
Wow.
And that was just after the the Specials Police Academy that they used to have, which I think back then was maybe a couple of weeks.
Wow.
From what I remember.
Wow. So when you became a police officer, like in those younger days, right, you were down the Cape, and then you transferred where over to where?
I When I left the Cape, I was at the district attorney's office out in New Bedford, and then I worked for the Raynham Police Department, part-time.
As part-time, too?
Yeah, I was there part-time for quite a while. You would say part-time, although at times we worked full-time. Mm. We were reserve intermittent officers.
Yeah.
But they would only be sending one person to the academy at a time, so you would kind of work full-time till someone went. And when you're time, you'd get to go.
Okay, excellent. So so you became full-time when you went to Taunton?
I was full-time before I went to Taunton. Before? I transferred to Taunton.
Okay. So tell us about, like, that career as, you know, an officer, right? We lost our son, Alex, right, a police officer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had so many, many interviews also over the time of us doing this. And many police officers have shared with us, you know, those things that they saw, whether it be a young police officer that maybe they didn't think it would bother them, but they were shoving it down and holding it back and getting out to do the job, and they didn't want to show any sign of weakness because you wanted to do your job well, right? That's what you were trained to do, to do it well. Was there any of those type of things that, you know, do you remember?
Yeah, I had a number of incidents. Some I'm not at liberty to discuss just because of legal stuff with it and whatnot. Yeah. But the bottom line is I did what all of us did back then. I just ignored it.
You ignored it?
Just ignored it. Just went to work. Was like, wow, that was some messed up stuff. Anybody else? No, we're good. And just go to work the next day.
Wow.
We weren't supposed to talk about it. We didn't talk about it. If you reached out for help, you were considered weak. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, we just went through it and ignored it and didn't talk about it at all.
Wow. So what did you use as a coping mechanism to deal with that type of stuff?
What did I use? I used a lot of isolation.
Isolation by yourself?
Yeah, a lot of time by myself. Isolating, avoiding situations where people might ask me, and I don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Because certain situations, if you did talk about in a crowd outside of law enforcement, maybe it's too much for them sometimes.
Yeah, get it.
Yeah, but a lot of times, too, is you just kind of acted like everything was good and back to work the next day and just ignore it and move on.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us a little bit about getting into, you know, what led you to Boulder Crest, okay. Right? About AJ, right?
Yeah. I was going to go backwards for a minute, too, because one of the other things, too, is back then, too, I didn't know where to go if I had a problem. Mm-hmm. We didn't know of any resources.
Yeah.
I mean, you would maybe, I guess, have to go to a supervisor or the boss, which is highly unlikely that anyone was going to do that.
Yep.
Why?
I didn't know what resources were available. Mm. There really wasn't available. I was involved in an incident in my career in which the agency was looking for resources for me, didn't really know it was available, basically got sent home and told, don't talk to anyone, we'll be in touch. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And I don't hold that against the agency because at the time they didn't know what resources were available because they hadn't encountered the experience that I had been through, so no one really knew what to do. So the advice was go home. I was very fortunate at that time. I held a legal defense fund. I was a member of the Fraternal Order of Police. So back then I was able to get an attorney through the FOP, and he happened to put me in touch with the Boston Police Peer Support Unit. And at that time in my career, I had no idea what peer support was. I didn't know any of that. Mm. All I knew was my lawyer, who the only person I was supposed to talk to, said to call there. So I'm going to go there because I didn't know what else to do.
So share with us what that was like, that experience was like being introduced to the peer support unit for the first time.
Yeah, it was actually pretty good. I guess it was good because I didn't have any I didn't have any idea what it was. So I didn't have a predisposed feeling of this might be negative or harmful or whatever. I didn't know.
Yeah.
At the time, the officers, they were very beneficial. There was a clinician there. I had never been to a clinician, never even thought about going to a clinician. If you asked me back then, I probably couldn't even tell you what it meant to be a clinician. Mm. But they were very beneficial in helping me to resolve some things that were going on at home related to some things at work.
Yeah,
where I didn't know how to address it, and they helped me to address that, understanding how kids process things, how your kids may be interpreting some of the events that you've been exposed to, because I'd never been told how to deal with them either. Mm. So my kids certainly didn't either. So that was very beneficial. Mm. But to me, on a personal level, what helped me a lot was the peer-to-peer contact with other officers. Mm. I had some things that I struggled with not really understanding things that were going on, and I think what happens during those times is you automatically go from maybe I did something wrong to thinking that maybe there's something wrong with me. Mm. What benefited me then was talking to other officers who had shared similar experiences and sharing their story.
Yeah.
And by the results of them sharing their story made me realize that I wasn't alone, that things I were experiencing were normal, considering the situation. And that to me was very beneficial.
Yeah. So I just picked up on, you know, your kids and family, because I'm big into, you know, having families and evolved, because I think if a police officer is struggling, or just in first response in general, families are also struggling too, right? Or having knows and what's going on. Did you know, you know, you said it was beneficial to talk about someone in a peer format, to be able to help me with something with the kids and how they were processing different things. Were you aware that your kids were you know, struggling, or were they?
They were very young at the time.
Yeah.
And it was obvious to me there were some things that they maybe had questions but didn't know how to ask, and that would make me want to get those things out of them.
Yeah.
And what you said is very accurate, and it goes along. We'll get into it a little more. But,
yeah,
you know, when you're hurting, you tend to hurt the people that you love the most.
Yeah.
And that's across the board. No one can deny that.
Yeah.
So it's very easy when you're struggling to, unfortunately, your family struggles as well, or they suffer the consequences of your struggle.
Yeah, they take the brunt of it, right?
Yeah, they really do.
Yeah, because they love you, right? And and no matter what, they're going to love you. So, yeah, it's hard to sort of understand that, like a lot of first responders who are listening out there. You know, if you're struggling now, your family knows you're struggling, and they're also struggling with you, right? So, you know, getting help is key, and we're going to get into that very, very much so, talking about that. So that was the start of you being introduced to peer support and being able to sort of unpack that backpack, so to speak.
Yeah, that was my introduction to it. As a result of that, I started to get calls when other people were involved in incidents in our region, knowing that I had some contacts at Boston Police Unit. So I would then start to bring them up. So other officers from other agencies could introduce the Boston Police, who was, they've been in business, I think it was like since the 60s. There's a great book about when they started. It was AA, actually, when they started.
Yeah.
Phenomenal full-time unit. And I do credit when we started the Semlec team. I'll throw the name out there, whether he's going to hear it or not. I don't know. Mark Freire was the sergeant of the unit at the time.
Yeah.
Was extremely helpful to us, along with everyone else in that unit. Pete Moscotaro, who was in it at the time. Monique Caesar is still in there. There were just some great people in that unit that really helped us to build up our team. So I do credit them with a lot of that. Because like I said, going into it, I don't even know what peer support was. I had absolutely no clue.
So when you got into that, you were like, wow, other people can benefit from this, right? Yeah. And then you wanted to start a peer support team?
No.
No,
I got voluntold.
You got told?
I got a phone call from someone who had been involved in an incident that I had brought up to Boston, and he became a chief, called to tell me that, hey, I just came from a chief's meeting. Guess what? You're going to form a peer support team. And I think my response might have been, well, that's great, but I don't work for you. And he was kind enough to put my chief on the phone, who was sitting next to him, apparently. So then I was introduced to several other people in the area, some that I knew from being in, you know, involved in some stuff. And it wasn't me alone by any means. We met a lot of people, and the group of us were able to create this team. And like I said, we pretty much tried to mimic Boston, except for the fact that we weren't full-time. We were part-time.
Yeah.
And one of those people that I did start with was Angelo LaPanna, AJ LaPanna, who was a sergeant at Middleborough Police at the time we started. Actually, I think he might actually have been a patrolman at the time and got promoted since then.
Mm.
And along with AJ and several others, we formed the team, and it worked, I think, pretty well. It was new to the region, so no one had heard of it like I hadn't. But over time, with the buy-in and the assistance from some of the chiefs and stuff, it became very busy.
So over time, you then became passionate about it, right? This is needed?
Oh, yeah. It was a part-time job. When I started, I was still a canine handler.
Yeah.
But it became a lot. If I wasn't on canine calls, we were doing peer support with someone or something, or trying to manage and get individuals, you know, set up to do that. So from debriefings to one-on-ones to all that stuff, and just trying to educate and spread the word so other people understood what it was, to understand that it's available to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How quick did it grow? Do you remember that?
I couldn't give you a time period, but we got busy pretty fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had some pretty major incidents occur within the region, and as a result of that, we became very active very quick. We also form relationships with all the other teams in the region. Metrolec work great with them. They were very beneficial and helpful when we get started as well.
Yeah.
And, of course, leaning into Boston a lot for some advice when we started.
Yeah, and they're all connected, right?
Absolutely.
They can all sort of help each other out, right?
And always do.
Yeah.
And always do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not unusual for one region to have an officer maybe from another region request help from them because for whatever reason they weren't comfortable in their region.
Yeah.
So we would just take care of that as well. And if someone from my region ended up in Boston, good for them.
Yeah.
Glad they reached out for help. Don't care where they got it as long as they got it.
Yeah. So the Semlik team would do debriefings. They would go in after a critical incident to departments. And then one-on-ones? Did you do one-on-one calls? Like someone struggling after those type of incidents?
Yeah, and that's a good question because that was the point where I really realized the difference. I got involved in that because of critical incidents. That's what I was involved in. Yeah. That's what everyone involved in got in touch with me. But as the team grew very quickly, we were getting lots of calls from people or from agencies sending us people that were struggling with, as I like to say, with life.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the lifestyle. Sometimes it's really, maybe there was a critical incident, but that's really not what was bothering them. It was, like you said,
Everything else. The
backpack was full, and that last critical incident was a rock that just brought them to their knees,
and
they needed some assistance.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, at that time, you know, sometimes their career may have already been gone, and that's why they were sent to us. Their marriage may be gone, and they were sent to us to try to help them, you know, from maybe not harming themselves and maybe not taking their own life, which is not always an easy task, and it's unfortunate that we were waiting till that point. And that's kind of where the Boulder Crest story kind of took off from there.
Yeah. So I just want to just follow up on that a little bit with the, you know, being someone referred to, right, to you. Then what were you guys able to do for the listener who might not even know what Semlik is, right, or Metrolik or any of these support teams for departments? Were you able to then refer them out to resources to be able to get help, right?
Yeah, there was a number of things. I mean, sometimes a lot of what it was sometimes was just being an open ear, just listening to them without judging them.
Yeah.
That's a lot of times as people were struggling with stuff that they felt they were alone, they were isolating, and didn't want to have that conversation because of the fear of judgment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we gave them the opportunity. We assigned someone to try to find out their age, their background, or their veterans and things, and, you know, take someone from our team. There were times we reached out to other teams. We thought maybe they had a peer that would fit into that situation better.
Yeah, yeah.
And just realize it was a lot of just a lot of listening. If it wasn't, you know, we would do a critical instance. We would do the debriefings and stuff. If it was alcohol-related and stuff, we had lots of contacts at various rehab facilities throughout the country that had programs for veterans and first responders.
Yeah.
And a lot of time it was just really just having conversations with people. And sometimes it wasn't even a conversation. I can remember driving around for hours with people, just listening to their story and giving them the opportunity to unload their backpack without judging them. And a lot of times, sometimes that's what it took.
Yeah.
It was just a little bit of getting the stuff out of the backpack and having a conversation.
I'm feeling heard, validated.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah.
To feel
it means
this
you're
way.
Human.
It means you're human, absolutely. And I love that he said that because, you know, the first responders, they work in a job that's trauma, right? Mm-hmm. They're dealing with trauma every day. And it's okay to have those human emotions, right, based on what you see every day.
Yeah, and if we, I don't mean to interrupt you, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
If we go with the word trauma, if we look at the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, we see a definition of trauma where the Greek word for trauma was wound. Mm-hmm. Where trauma may be an event where your life was in serious jeopardy or harm of injury or death or serious sexual assault. If we go by that definition alone, then it could be every single day that a first responder goes to work.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? That would be trauma. So what I've learned through time is trauma is individual. It's in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. What's traumatic for me may be a walk on the beach for a day for you. Everyone is different. We may work a lot together. Lots of hours, lots of time together, but do we truly really know what everyone is dealing with? Absolutely not. Mainly because none of us share it anyway.
Yeah.
So how would you?
Yeah.
So if you and I were to go to a critical incident, what you categorize as a critical incident, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a call that for some reason or another impacted me because of something I experienced in my own life.
Yeah.
That's going to have more of an impact on me than it may on you.
Yes.
So you may be able to say that was traumatic for me, but not for you. Well, then sometimes what that does in the first responder field is, well, why is it traumatic? There must be something wrong with me.
Yes.
Linda was there with me. Linda was great. Jay, he did good. What's wrong with me? There's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And that's not, that's very, very rarely the answer.
Yeah. There's some other guys on that call with me, and they all seem to be okay, but I'm not feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes those other first responders are having a similar experience and having similar thoughts, and nobody's talking about it. And then other times it goes over to that crossover between the job and private life that you were talking about earlier. If somebody, the same first responder can respond to similar calls at different points in their life. And when they have a number of personal stressors going on, then at that point, you know, it can have a different impact on them.
Absolutely.
And I think that's common. When you talk about, you know, listening non-judgmentally, I think that is one of, if not the most important part of the process. When someone who has the mindset and the personality of a rescuer, and it's difficult for them, especially with like the cultural norms that we're trying to undo now, but about, you know, suck it up and drive on and all of that, when they finally get to a point that they're ready to talk, it's a release, man. And just to touch back on one other comment that you had about it's not likely for someone to go to their bosses or the chief. When you talk about listening non-judgmentally, just sort of based on their duty, I don't know that that person would be able to do it, right? There's valid concerns with bringing it there. I think that your description of those chiefs, you know, calling you on the phone, it sounds like a really responsible approach to having someone to delegating that responsibility in a responsible manner. So the question that I have is, why is it unlikely that someone is going to approach, you know, the administration with these problems? Why has there been so much more success with peer support and other networks?
I think it could be a couple of reasons. I mean, sometimes if you do go to the boss, they have an obligation as the boss.
Right.
And that's what they have to follow. I think, too, that there is a huge difference between management and leadership.
Yeah.
And I think that, to me, is the answer to your question. Because you hold rank doesn't make you a leader, and because you don't hold rank doesn't mean you aren't a leader. I've met a lot of people through my career that never held rank that I absolutely would refer to as leaders, and I would follow them anywhere they went. And the question comes down, do you lead by example or do as I say and not as I do?
Right.
You know? Yeah.
So that to me is the answer, a true leader. And the other thing with the peer support too is, quite honestly, the team and any team without the assistance or without the partnership with the leadership, it's not going to work.
Right.
It has to be hand in hand. It has to work together. They have to have the trust and in you as the team, and you have to have enough in them that you know they're going to reach out for the right reasons and stuff.
Right, right.
So I think that's a huge part of it. It's not, the team is not, to me, a separate thing. The leadership of the agency is what's going to make it work, especially if they have the confidence in the team to refer to it.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, they should support it in the way that they do when one of their department members enter the healthcare system. The same, I believe, should occur, that type of support and administration when somebody enters the mental health care system.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the key words that Rob used there was trust, you know, fostering the trust and belief, like safe, right? If a first responder goes to seek help and there's someone else looking on within the department and this guy is ridiculed or does retribution because he went to seek help, and the guy looking on is going like, I'm not going to go and ask for help because it's going to happen to me. But on the flip side of that, if someone's looking on and he sees a guy going and seeking help within this department and he supported, I'm just using he as an example, but he's supported and he's coming back to work and he's well and he's feeling good, another guy is going to look on and say, well, okay. I know if that ever happens to me, if I need help, I feel good about going and seeking help for.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. Yeah, I think there's a couple things that prevent people too. I think one thing is, you know, knowing that if I go for professional help, I'm going to get a diagnosis, PTSD, anxiety, depression.
Yep.
I know Josh likes to use the word as denial is more than just a river in Egypt. If you know that you're going to get that diagnosis, the question comes in to the fact of, can I have a diagnosis like this and do my job? If they prescribe me medication, can I take medication and do my job? If I'm a police officer, can I carry a gun when I'm on this medication? These are all unanswered questions. So what we would normally do in a situation like that in the culture is deny there's anything wrong with us.
Right.
I don't need to go for help because I'm fine. There's an acronym for fine. I'll try to be polite and not use the whole thing. I think Jay obviously knows what it is.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard me say it before or somewhere else.
I've heard it.
But that's part of the thing with seeking the help is knowing that, you know, and the other thing too is, and I can speak solely for a lot of law enforcement training, but we have basically taught a life of diminishment because of this job. We repeatedly teach PTSD awareness, PTSD, how to make sure you don't have it, or if someone else has it, how to identify it, and suicide awareness and suicide. So if you have an officer that's not suicidal, just not happy in life, Having a hard time at home, having a hard time at work and at home, the transition, none of that's working. Mm. What do you do? Mm. Do you go out to a professional and reach help? Do you deny there's anything wrong with you? Usually we go with the denial thing and yeah. just don't talk about it and we move forward.
Right.
And we're actually not moving forward, kind of staying still.
Yeah, it's like I'm either staying still, but I'm in, and I feel it's like also in the back of the head. I mean, Jay shared this in his own, you know, I was going to fix this myself.
Yeah, 100%.
And then help yeah. others, mm-hmm. you know. You want to chime in on that?
Yeah, so that was, you know, my initial approach when I first began to recognize, whoa, I'm having some symptoms here, and this is new to me, right? I've always mostly felt a sense of pride associated with my service in the military and the fire service. And all of a sudden, uh-oh, what's going on with mm-hmm. me? And there were things that were more noticeable to me, like a change in attitude and behaviors and frustration and tension. And then, you know, there was other stuff that went a little bit deeper. But I couldn't talk to anybody, which from this point in my life seems silly, right? Yeah. For lack of a better word. But so I, rather than taking that simple step in reaching out for help, I went back to college in my 30s and I was going to get a degree and start helping other people. And through that process, I hoped that I would discover the tools and come to understand how to heal my own self without ever having to tell anybody that I suffered. And then I would go on to help other first responders. Now, it didn't work that way. I eventually fell apart and had to sort of discover myself and learn how to heal from where I was at now and accept that trauma had impacted me and that was okay. And learn to cope more. And I, you know, it was such a beneficial process, but certainly didn't go the way that I expected it to, right? Yeah. I'm going to go get a college degree, tell nobody that I struggled, and then help other people. And
I'll be able to help myself in the meantime also.
Very quietly, I'll help myself, yeah.
And it doesn't work that way,
no,
right?
No, it does not.
No, and that's not unusual. What you just said probably describes a large majority of people that end up on peer support teams and stuff.
Yeah.
We're in a profession of service and serving others, so that's what we're good at. That's what we do.
That's what we do.
So it's very easy to do that and help other people and just continuously ignore yourself in the process.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, the more I do that, well, maybe I'll get a little bit out of it in the process.
Yeah.
But in actuality, what we're doing is ignoring ourselves and putting all of our energy and effort into other people.
Yes.
And then when you get to the point where I like to say that life is living you,
yeah,
and you're
yeah,
not
yeah.
living life, sometimes yeah. that's where you get to the point where it's the realization of, wait a minute, I got to slow this down a little bit.
Yeah.
Like holy crap, a lot of time has passed, and I didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in the game.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of the benefit to that process, too, is even if you go into it a little short-sighted or not understanding the work that one has to do for themselves, when you get in the environment where you start learning about symptomology and trauma and what's been going on, that's when, you know, those realizations at least happen for me. And I don't think mm-hmm. it's uncommon because it's the human condition, right? And you're like, okay, all right, I'm either a phony or I'm going to fix myself now, one or the
yeah.
other.
Yeah. And that kind of goes into, you had asked about like getting involved in Struggle Well and how yeah. I came across Boulder Crest and stuff. So my friend that I talked about with AJ had, him and I were on our way out to Texas to speak in front of the International Chiefs of Police mm-hmm. on forming a regional peer support team. And on the plane on the way out, AJ read the book Struggle Well. Mm. Literally right when we got off the plane, handed me the book. He had read the whole book on the flight and said, you got to read this. The Semlik team was having a conference in Southeastern Mass in Wareham a couple months later, and it was the first one of its kind. We ended up having about 350 attendees from around New England.
Wow.
We had officers come from Sandy Hook Elementary, Pulse nightclub shooting, the shooting in Las Vegas at the music festival.
Yep.
And they all came to share their story and stuff. So AJ had emailed Josh Goldberg, the author of the book. I laughed at AJ thinking, what are the chances an author of a book is going to call us back? Yeah. Weirdly enough, Josh did, out of however many emails he gets. And they came to the conference and they presented. And all they asked in return was that myself, AJ, and he had brought some people from the Gary Sinise Foundation with him,
yeah.
That we talk after. He just wanted to ask us questions. I know you had Josh on the program. Yeah. You described Boulder Crest started with combat veterans, with retreats. And at the time, they were just starting to look into the first responder culture. So Josh basically came and interrogated AJ and I for about 3 or 4 hours in a conference room at the hotel at the end of the night because he wanted to learn about the first responder culture.
Yeah.
So it was AJ's, I think AJ's thirst for knowledge and education and looking for it. AJ formed the team with me, and AJ was one of the few people early on that was one of the ones that would talk and didn't care about judgment. Okay. That he would talk about his struggles. He'd talk about challenges. With AJ. AJ was a Green Beret Special Forces, was in the National Guard, had multiple deployments, mm-hmm. and was a police officer in Middleborough as well. Unfortunately, AJ was diagnosed with cancer 3 years ago, and AJ passed this past October.
Yeah.
So it was AJ's introduction to Josh, to Struggle Well, that started this whole program that now has kind of taken off in Massachusetts. Mm. So, and unfortunately, he's not here to be doing it with us. Dearly missed on a regular basis.
Well, he's still around you guys, believe me, guiding you, and I'm sure you ask him for guidance too.
All the time.
Along the way. Yeah, absolutely. I can sure. So that led you to the Struggle Well program, right? And the Boulder Crest. You got to meet Josh. We both read the book, by the way.
Okay.
And I remember reading it. I mean, when Jay went down to the Cape to do that conference down there, I remember saying, oh my God, this is absolutely amazing. You would love this. You would absolutely love this. And so I got the book and I read it and I'm like, I can't put this thing down. It's absolutely amazing, right?
Yeah.
And do you want to share on what you're doing with the book now?
Yeah,
Before we get into it?
Yeah, so as Linda said, we both read the book, got a lot out of it. I loved, the program, the class. And yeah. Right now I run a veterans group that focuses on managing symptoms and coping skills. And initially, I was having a little difficulty getting group members to share. And I had the book, right? So I said, hey, why don't we read a little bit out of this and see if there's anything in this, particular story within the book that we're able to relate to how this person is struggling and how they manage to cope. How they managed to struggle well, and it worked so well that I started at the beginning of the book, and now I'm reading the book again, but slowly and outlining, little parts, and I'm getting even more going through it that way, where this is where we're going to pause and share on can anyone relate to these circumstances, and we're going through the whole book, and these guys love it.
Yeah.
And it is so helpful.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
AJ early on would say that, he couldn't get back to where his life was before some of the things that he had dealt with, the struggles throughout his life. And then the book was what helped him to realize that he didn't have to live a life of diminishment and coping and diagnosis diminishment as a result of those things, that there was growth.
Yeah.
That there's growth on the other side. And the book is based on the science of post-traumatic growth.
Yep.
And after reading that, that's where it was a big eye-opener for him. Like I said, he invited Josh. Josh came down. As a result of that meeting, Josh invited us each to go out to their Warrior Path program, which is a retreat on location training. I went out to Arizona. I went first. And again, my goal was going out there. I'm going to get all this, bring it back for the team. And I think it was about day one of training, about halfway through it, they were going through some of the class. And this is training. It's a training class.
Yeah.
And as they were going through some of the slides, they read one, and it just light bulbs went off in my head, and I was like, okay, they're talking about me. Yep. Now, how did they find out about me? How do they know about me? This is weird. I was older than the other people that I went with. There was only, I think, seven of us in the class together. I was the only one that was not in the military, so I had a little bit of uncomfortableness being there. I remember my wife saying to me before I left, you know what a retreat is, right? And I was like, no. Like, I have no idea where I'm going. Got there, had no idea what I was getting into, but I was going for the team. I was going to bring it back.
Yeah.
Never expected to take place what took place as of being there, but I also had my own struggles. I had stuff that I'd never dealt with, that I wasn't dealing with. Running the team was a little unique for me because there weren't a lot of people that, and nothing against them personally, but I couldn't lean into a lot of people because I was running the team.
Yeah.
And again, life was living me. I was in K-9. I spent a little time on the SWAT team. My career, I started on call, not mandatory, but when you're one of only a handful of dogs on a department and they call you, I was obligated to come in.
Yeah.
That's how I always looked at it. So I was on call from 96 until 2022 when I retired.
Wow.
Between K-9 peer support and SWAT and then in detectives.
Yeah. A lot.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah, a lot. It was not unusual to have a cell phone glued to me all the time. But when I got to that training, it ended up really, as soon as they started to talk and I recognized all these things that I was dealing with, really caused me to kind of check where my feet were at.
Yeah.
And the rest of that week, I stopped and was like, the team can get this later. It's my turn. And I leaned into it myself, and I didn't know what I was going there for.
I love that.
And that's happening a lot with the classes that we run now, is people don't know what they're doing there and get there, and I'm like, wait a minute, how do you guys know me? How did you know I was dealing with this? And we know that everyone's dealing with it because, as we said earlier, struggle is inevitable, suffering is an option. Yeah. I don't care who you are, what you do for a living. I don't care if you're a first responder. I don't care if you're a mailman or picking up trash.
Yeah.
At some point in your life, you're going to encounter a difficult situation. Your dog might get hit by a car. You get an illness. You lose a loved one. Could be any number of things. You can't avoid it.
Yeah.
But there is value in that. If you learn through this training and learn about the science of post-traumatic growth, is to self-reflect and research and look into these situations in your life and take the value out. And we talk about the rocks in the backpack. Maybe some rocks you just don't pick up.
Yeah.
Right? Or maybe you realize with that rock during some self-reflection and stuff that maybe the lesson is worth carrying, but maybe the rock isn't.
Yeah.
And it's time to get rid of that rock and move on.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such a novel concept, too, that so many people hadn't heard, right? Like, I had always thought of PTSD as, you know, now you got it, and now you're gonna suffer. The concept of struggling well, just hearing the theory behind it, that, wait a minute, there might be lessons in this. There might be growth in this. I might be better off for having this difficult experience if I just change my perspective and how I look at, you know, the circumstances as they unfolded and find the benefits in you know, as they relate to me and moving forward.
Yeah.
What a relief it is just to hear that and begin to believe that it's possible. And then when you find out it's true, that's even better.
No, 100%. Sounds like you've been to a struggle well class, right?
Yeah. No, there's so much strength in that. You know what I mean? Right? I mean, you feel strong. I mean, talk about, like, taking control, allowing yourself to actually take control of your own life, right, rather than life taking control of you, right? And
exactly.
And you can either go either way, and which one feels better, you being in control and taking control of your own life rather than giving it out to the world. Mm-hmm. It just feels so much better, right, when I want to live that way. Yeah, for sure. So then you went through the whole Warrior Path program.
Yes.
How long was the program? Share with us
about that. It's a week-long program. I was out in Arizona, went through it out in Arizona. At the time, I think it was about an 18-month follow-up. So following the program, that's one big thing with Ken Falk, the founder of Boulder Crest, along with Josh, was they don't want to be a one-and-done. So it's not a class. You feel great. You leave. And then 2 days later, you're back in the reality of your own life and everything you forgot about.
Yeah.
So we had group calls with the group that we were with. We have an app that was a follow-up to it, and there was weekly, every few weeks it would gradually diminish as time went on with the main guide that led the class. So as a group, we would get together and we would go over a lot of the modules and we would still work on things together.
Mm.
And I'm still very close friends with at least two of the people that I went with. We talk on a regular basis.
Yes.
So So
the initial class is a 5-day?
Yeah.
5-day, like a week, right?
Yeah, it was like a week, and that was on location, which Boulder Crest now is partnered. I think there's a total of, I'm going to guess and say 11 or 13 across the country where they partner with.
Yeah.
They own two facilities, one in Virginia, one in Arizona.
Yeah.
There's one that a lot of people from this region go to is the Travis Mills Foundation up in Maine.
Okay.
And they run the Warrior Path program up there.
Yeah.
And there's do a phenomenal job.
Yeah. And the reason why do they have to branch out beyond the two locations themselves? Why? Can you share with us why do they have to? It's just so big.
Yeah. It's the request for it. Even in Massachusetts alone, which we can explain the struggle well in a minute, but it's the request for training of really, we're 1 year into it right now, just over 1 year since we started in Massachusetts, and
Kidding
the request
me, wow.
are nonstop.
Wow. So it's getting out there. Word is getting out there.
All word
sure.
of mouth, yeah. We I'm to the point now we try not to advertise,
yeah.
only because we're really big on quality, not quantity.
Yeah.
We are completely run by philanthropists that pay this, so we do not charge agencies for these classes.
Mm-hmm.
So it works out well that it's not a sales pitch trying to sell it.
Yeah.
We're funded by individuals like the Gary Sinise Foundation, Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus, AT&T FirstNet is a big supporter.
Oh, that's huge. Yeah,
AT&T FirstNet was absolutely huge in helping us get going with the project.
Yeah.
So we're doing a lot in the region right now. We've moved from different disciplines. We do corrections, a lot of stuff with corrections right now, especially the Mass Department of Corrections and some sheriff's departments that we're doing a lot of work with.
Yeah, the goal is, when we talked to Josh, was to have every police department, right, in the nation trained in struggle well and to be able to do that. So, and it's happening. Bit by bit, right?
Yeah.
It's happening bit by bit. And again, you know, the Warrior Path and who teach the Warrior Path classes or trainings for those individuals, that's grown too, because the demand, as you said, the request for those trainings is getting so big. So I think they like partnered with like-minded wellness retreat type of things, and then taught them. We just interviewed Donna Brown, right? Who's down in Florida, and she just finished her training for to be a trainer down in Florida for Struggle Well.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Police officer down in Florida. So tell us about now, you came back from the Warrior Path, right? You sort of went into the Struggle Well. Did you end up bringing it back to the team?
I came back from the Warrior Path, and the next on the list was AJ. So AJ went to the training after me.
Yeah.
I didn't tell him anything about it because it kind of have to be your own experience. And if I tried to explain it to him, he wouldn't have understood anyway.
Yeah.
AJ went shortly after me, came back, felt the same way I did, thought it was great. We need to share it with more. We started to use it to refer people. When we had officers that were struggling, we were able to, you know, to reach out to Josh and stuff. And we got quite a few from this region into that training. Over time, Josh kept in touch with me. He would call me periodically and, hey, can you come to Florida for a week? So I was taking time out of work, and I was going and doing some trainings with them down in Florida when they started with the Struggle Well. Mm. Because when Josh met with us is when they were trying to learn more of the culture.
Yeah.
And it kind of expanded in the South Florida region.
Yeah.
So I did a number of classes there. And then just periodically over a few years, I met Josh in 2019. So in 2020, January is when I went to the Warrior Path. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I just kind of started volunteering my time and kind of going around the country with Josh as often as I could, because I was still working for a good part of it.
Yeah.
And going to do classes at different agencies and different disciplines throughout the country.
Yeah. So you said like 2019 and then going to 2020, COVID hit. Like, what was that like, trying to expand your experience, I suppose, with Struggle Well? And then how did you notice any, an increase of need, I suppose, in law enforcement for help?
Yeah, during COVID, I was in detective, so we got kind of just trying to figure out how to do our job with COVID, basically, and that was time-consuming in and of itself for anyone involved in the first responder world. That was a brand-new thing that nobody knew anything about. We didn't know where we were going with it.
Yeah.
The Struggle Well thing, I know they went virtual with some different things, but for a while, the Warrior Path, I believe, was not taking place because of it.
Yeah.
But then after that is when we really started to see, at least me personally, the influx of people trying to get some kind of assistance and stuff.
But were you still on the Semlec team too?
Yes.
Yeah. So did you notice that, like, from those one-on-one calls then?
Yeah, there's a lot of one-on-ones. And in Taunton at the time, we made arrangements with me and several other members of the team that were peers on Taunton. Anyone that went out with COVID, we would make phone calls to and periodically check in and make sure everybody was good and stuff like that.
Mm.
But like I said, there was so much unknown with that. Now it's easy to look back and say we could have, should have, would have, or should have done this or shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But at the time, none of us knew what was going on or what direction to go in.
Mm.
Right.
And after that is when we did start to get a lot busier with stuff after that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very noticeable. I mean, clinicians were booked out. I mean, trying to get into, if you referred someone to get help, like a therapist, right? They were booked out. So you were sort of left in the lurch of, well, where do I go now? What do I do? So share with us now, like, where you are. You started off the Struggle Well with AJ, took it back and obviously did all the trainings up here. How did it become like a Massachusetts chapter? How did that happen?
That happened. My retirement date was coming up. I had told Josh I planned on retiring. Didn't really have a job planned. I was going to pump gas down the marina where my boat was, which I thought sounded like fun. But part of me knew that I was going to be missing out on the service part because I'd done it so long. And I did struggle a bit towards the end with the fear of a loss of identity. Where I'd been a police officer for so long. But having gone through this training, there's a lot that we talk about in modules about that. That kind of prepped me for it, so I wasn't as fearful of that.
Yeah.
I was fortunate that Boulder Crest got some funding. The funding was Massachusetts was within the marketing region for people that gave the funding. So Josh asked if we would be willing to start and bring Struggle Well to Massachusetts.
Wow.
So basically, I had worked with some agencies to help them create some peer support teams that ended up joining ours along with Metrolec. So they sponsored the first few classes. So I had one of the individuals from Boulder Crest come in and do the classes with me, the first two. And then I was able to build up. We call people guides, not trainers or instructors.
Guides, yeah.
And the reason behind that is I'm not going to sit in the room with, 20 or 25 people with hundreds of years of experience and tell them, I'm going to train you how to live your life, or I'm going to teach you how to do things right. Yeah. We can guide you in the right direction. The only thing we have as an advantage over anyone that comes to our classes is that we've been aware of this stuff a little bit longer than they have.
Yeah.
And had the opportunity to work with it. And, you know, as we describe in class, life like a sine wave, there's ups and downs. Mm-hmm. This class is not going to prevent struggle. You're still going to have struggles. I would call this more of a preparation to prepare people for when these things happen. And when you're in the first responder world, you know, you have life and you have your life struggles and personal issues and marriage and family and deaths and whatever it is at home.
Yeah.
And then you add work to it. Right now we have all the work struggles. So now we got to forget about our family stuff when we go to work, and we got to forget about our work stuff when we go back to our family.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're not supposed to mix those two together. Yeah. And in actuality, you can't prevent that.
That's right.
So the saying, it's a quote, is that struggle is inevitable, but suffering is an option. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when struggle happens, what are you going to do about it? And my question, one thing that was AJ's big thing is we're waiting around for people to hit rock bottom. And that's when we're trying to help them, and they're in a place just full of emotions and not in a great place in their life or a great time in their life. Why aren't we training them beforehand? If we've trained all police officers in the use of force right up until deadly force. How many police officers have gotten training in the academy on their agency of what to do when you do that?
Mm.
None. What about CPR, first aid, when you do it to a child, when you do it to a loved one? Mm-hmm. What if it doesn't work? What if you do it to a child and you knew the child, or you have a child of similar age at home? You're struggling with that. What do you do about it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've never addressed that. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've trained everyone to do these somewhat, I mean, even in the military, heroic acts, right, of completely ignoring your own safety to help other people. But if it doesn't work out and you get some type of an injury, whether it be physical or whatever, the question then becomes, what are you going to do? And most times, I don't know. No one ever told me. No one ever taught me.
Mm. Right.
That's what I really liked about the struggle well training was kind of get left to bang. Prepare for these things when they come instead of waiting till it happens. Because you can't avoid it. And anyone in the profession, you can't deny that it's going to happen. Look at the suicide rates of law enforcement, of first responders. Look at the heart attacks. Look at the fact that we have a heart bill. Not easy to get, but what does that tell you? Tell you is that heart conditions are a result of the stress that you obtain during work. Yeah. So what are you doing to metabolize that stress?
Mm.
You're doing nothing because we have a problem with heart attacks. We lost more officers in Taunton to cancer than we did to heart attacks or line of duty deaths. We experienced suicides and all that stuff when I worked there, but a lot of the things are related to just stress in general.
Yeah.
And we can all acknowledge it's part of the job, but we still sit around and wait until someone's at rock bottom to try to help them. And I think we need to get kind of ahead of it.
Yeah. I also believe that someone who hits rock bottom, you know, a first responder, also waits until they hit rock bottom before they reach out themselves to get help. Again, going back to sort of what Jay said, you know, I was trying to fix this myself, you know, and I didn't want anyone to know my business, which is also a big part of, you know, the stigma that goes on in departments. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Stigma.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Yeah. I'm going to describe a first responder. Okay. And I say that one, if not many of these work at every agency that I've ever dealt with across the country. Mm-hmm. Drink themselves to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. Their children are afraid of them because they're always angry. When they leave for work, they have a verbal, borderline physical, domestic with their loved one. Can't wait to get out of the house. But that's a tough person because they're not reaching out to someone for help.
Mm.
Right? That's the toughest guy in the department, right? Mm-hmm. If you have that same officer who says, hey, Jay, I know you dealt with some shit before, but you seem to be doing pretty good right now. Can you tell me how you did that? Mm-hmm. That's looked at as a weakness. That's absolutely ridiculous. That's how I look at it now. And I didn't always look at it this way. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
I grew up in the culture of looking at it as, I'll never tell anyone that. I don't need them to think this of me or think that of me. But in actuality, if you're living to the point that your own children are afraid of you because you have such a short fuse, which may be the result of some of the training that you've required to react to situations instead of responding to them, which is something we talk about a lot because reactionary skills in the first responder in the military culture keeps you alive, right? Can't wait. I don't have time to make a decision on this.
Yes.
And sometimes we go to calls, same call, same place over and over again. We made up our mind before we even got in the cruiser to drive to that call. Yeah. We knew what the result of that call was going to be because we've been there so many times.
Mm.
So
yeah.
Yeah, and historically, we don't talk about how training for these situations is going to translate and carry over into other areas of our life. And, you know, like you said, what if the CPR on the infant doesn't work, right? Many of us have a passing thought during a class, but this sort of, okay, and then that's where it stays. And your experience sort of exemplifies, you know, exactly what you're talking about when you talk about preparing for retirement. I kind of knew maybe I'd be missing service and there might be a lack of purpose, but I was prepared because I got involved in this stuff. And we have so many slides that that's a common theme among first responders to feel, mm-hmm. you know, we're purposeful, man. And we feel that loss. And having this information at a different time, you know, preemptively prepared you for that. And you were able to make a smoother transition. And I think, you know, that really illustrates the bigger point that you're making, as I understand it, which is we need to introduce this information at a different time in the lives of first responders, preemptively, before they find themselves a crisis. Because in my experience, not only was I self-stigmatizing, but once I reached out for help, I was very fortunate to have a lot of good people that cared about me, a lot of support, and I was put in touch with resources. But I didn't know about them before that, right? And if somebody had told me in advance, I don't know what it would have been different, right? It's just like, but I want the next person to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To not get to rock bottom.
Yeah, I want the next person to have the information earlier on so that as they begin to notice those behavior changes in themselves, as we said, the family struggles together, they heal together too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They benefit when a loved one of a first responder begins to address, first of all, accept that they're struggling, and if they're fortunate enough and determined enough to recognize the benefits of those struggle, which is absolutely a truth, the whole family benefits from that. The communication changes, everybody's well-being improves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's benefit all around.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. First responders out there and families who are listening in, just having a dialogue going back and forth here about, you know, getting that information and, you know, not waiting until you get rock bottom before you seek help. Just strengthen that, Jay, right? I mean, you know, you said earlier on, I didn't go to seek help because I didn't have the courage. Yeah, right? I had to develop that courage to go and seek help. Basically, I'm going to be the first one to use an F-bomb on, I think.
Okay,
on
good. Thank you. Could have done it a little earlier. It would have been a good icebreaker, but go ahead.
Basically, stop giving an F, right, about what other people think about you.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to chime in on that, guys? Like, stop giving an F.
I think the quote that was given to me recently, too, is what other people think of me is none of my business.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at now. Wish I had been there earlier in life. But if you're doing the good thing and you're happier in your home life or during the times that you're not, I mean, that's the other thing, too. I think all this training is great, just like therapy is great for some people and stuff, but you're still going to encounter another struggle. So there's going to be times where you go down, but what I really liked about what Struggle Well is it gave me a roadmap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if I do start to go down a rabbit hole, be miserable, I know other people, I can actually show you a roadmap. These are things you can do that you have to do, most importantly, to get yourself out of that or to prevent yourself from going so far, or maybe you're not there as long as you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it's not prevention, but it does give you a means and it gives you a roadmap. Where before it was kind of along the lines, and this is most people I've talked to in the professions is, hey, look, I took this job. I knew this shit was going to happen. This is it. Like, this is my life. I chose it. I own it. Can't complain about it. It was my choice.
Exactly.
I got to get to the end. I got to get that pension.
Yep.
So I'm certainly not going to change it right now.
Yeah.
And nowadays, as you see older officers, it's waiting till the end. Got to get to the pension. Got to get to the pension. But are you going to get there and are you going to be miserable in the process?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that how can you sustain? You talked about this long career, right? You're 25 years or whatever it might be. How can a first responder sustain a long career without learning how to be able to manage what they're going through? I don't think it can. At some point, it's not a matter of if that's going to happen. It's going to be a matter of when, right?
Individualized. Yeah. And some people already have some. I know a lot of people talk about tools and wellness tools. We talk about practices. Tools are good when something's broken to fix it.
Yeah.
We use practices so that these are things you do with intentionality every day. Prepare yourself for when the time is going to come instead of waiting and trying to learn it once the time comes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. And there are people out there there's people that do these practices, don't recognize it.
Yeah.
But the practices also have to be, we talk about a wellness triangle in our training, and they have to be in more than just physical fitness. So, and I don't like the expression of mental health and mental wellness. If you use that in the first responder culture, some people will automatically just
switch off,
don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's overall wellness. if your finances are not in a good place and you're struggling with finances, how is your mind? Are you in a good place? You're happy every day? No. How's your physical fitness? Can you afford the gym membership? Are you going to the gym? Are you taking advantage of that? Do you have the time to, or are you working too many details and too much overtime because your finances are messed up? So when you pull finances out of the picture as being, you know, your finances are stable, you got a good cushion, you're making some extra money and whatnot, as soon as you pull the finances out, your mental health goes down. Your physical health may go down. And then your inner spirit goes down as a part of that.
Yeah.
So it's all connected. So yes, if we put so much concentration on your mental health and mental well-being, that could, if you're practicing all these practices just on mental health, but you're not paying attention to your bank account, or you're not eating healthy, or you're not doing some exercise, guess what? Your mental health at some point is going to struggle as a result of it.
Part of it.
Yeah. So it's overall wellness.
Yes. Yeah, financial wellness is a huge, huge, huge part of your overall wellness for sure. Because I think if a first responder is overwhelmed and he's overworked and he's tired and he's all this stuff, I think the last thing he's thinking about is paying that car payment. And then it just manifests into other things. So, yes, financial wellness is a huge part of all of it, right?
Yeah, and you get into a little bit of shopping therapy, right?
Yeah.
You work in those details. You make good money, Amazon truck. Pain in the ass when it's blocking half the road in front of you, but if it's in front of your house, feels real good when you get home and open that package at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So finances, your inner spirit, meaning like your true north.
Yeah.
You look in the mirror in the morning, are you actually living the values that you say? Are you a leader that's telling people what to do, but you're not actually living it?
Yeah.
That if you don't have a good, strong inner spirit, then you tend to live your life based on the judgment of others.
Yeah.
So that inner spirit is huge. But those are all things that there are practices and things you can do instead of waiting until your spirit is broken because your finances are a mess. Now you're having a medical problem. Now you can't work the extra money to settle the finances, and your mental wellness goes right, you know, to the toilet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all connected. And it's all you have to have a strong triangle, we would say, to keep it going, and you can't ignore one branch of that or one side of it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Spiritual wellness too, right?
Yeah.
All part of it for sure. I mean, you think about that now, you know, where you are, if you're a first responder or family listening and you're noticing some of these things at home, you know, maybe it's time to have just a conversation, right? Just to have a conversation about yourselves and where are we at? You know, what can we do to make this better? Who can we see? Who can we talk to? Can we go to a struggle well class? Where are these held? You know, when you think about that type of stuff, it's important to be able to have those conversations and connections. Families, can we talk a little bit about families?
Sure.
Like getting into that. How is there a program offered with Struggle Well for families yet? I know that it's coming.
There's a pilot that's being done out in Arizona, out of Tucson. That's coming up within the next month or so.
Yeah.
And after they pilot it out there, I'm going to work on bringing some of that back here. And the training is going to be pretty much the same as it is for the first responders.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, when we do the leadership training, we do offer executive leadership. And when we do that training, we're not teaching them about a program they can bring back to the agency. We're starting with them. So you got to take care of yourself. And it's the same thing with the family.
Yeah.
The family is beneficial if they learn stuff from Struggle Well. Able to benefit themselves. You can lead and show by example. The rest of the family sees it. But also, if you're struggling, they'll be on the same page and know things that can help you.
Yeah.
But I don't really know that it's a great idea to come to a family and teach you totally how to support your family member that's a first responder and not give you the opportunity to utilize this stuff to benefit yourself.
Yeah,
because absolutely. You're not going to be able to help them if you're not in a good place yourself, just like we said with peer support. It's no different.
Yeah, I think that also a lot of families, you know, of a first responder, you know, I know now in hindsight, right, 5.5 years later, that there's so much resources available for a first responder to get help. We didn't know that, right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
I didn't know that 5 years ago. I think if I had been aware of it or educated, wow, these are the things that, you know, we can do to help ourselves, but also be able to reach in to maybe not be afraid of approaching a conversation with Alex, right? And be able to guide him to resources and also help ourselves, right? And help him through whatever he was going through. But there's so much resources. But families of first responders are sort of left out at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think if a child is struggling for a first responder, child is struggling at home or in school and they're not getting the resources that maybe in school, those things can then get carried into work, right? Into work on a first responder, and they can struggle with that, which it affects them too. So beneficial for families to get involved and get trained and struggle well, right?
We're working on it.
So I absolutely love that. We did talk to Josh about that too, right?
Yeah,
I'm never going to leave the families out because it's very important.
Oh, absolutely.
Very, very important.
Yeah.
So how many classes are being taught? Trainings or classes? What do you call them? Trainings? Classes?
Trainings, yeah. Trainings? Training or class, yeah.
So how many are being taught, like, monthly?
Oh, geez. It depends on the month. I can tell you we've had some weeks where we've had... Well, what we do is we offer the first class is really a five-day class. A lot of agencies struggle with overtime and backfilling shifts, so we also can offer it a two-day, yeah, which is a sort of shorter version of the five-day.
Yeah.
We also, like right now for the Department of Corrections, we're doing their in-service. I think we have 39 weeks. We do 8 hours every Monday for every agent, every corrections officer, every employee of the DOC that goes through their in-service training.
Oh.
Right now, we're to the point, I think I was trying to figure this out, with Nancy Liedberg. She does the logistics with me, and I think we're probably around 2,500 first responders in Massachusetts that we've trained in the last year.
Wow.
Believe it or not, because I think it's over 1,400 at the DOC alone, in addition to the probably close to 1,000 that have gone through our 2 and 5 day classes.
Wow. So is there a projection, like, for the rest of the year?
We've kind of knocked it down a little bit, and we're concentrating on two really large agencies that we're working with right now, because our big thing is quality over quantity.
Yeah.
So we're working on building up more guides so that we can have more agencies and stuff, but we're not just training people and throwing them out as instructors. It does take, it's a little different training, as you guys have both experienced.
Mm.
So we want to make sure we have the right people in the room.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, the goal eventually, I know with Boulder Crest, it was started with combat veterans, first responders, next in line was frontline healthcare workers, and eventually teachers was something that was on their list.
Mm.
Because this material, and it's interesting, when you go to a class, we're not really telling anyone things they don't already know.
Right.
Other than maybe you don't know of the term post-traumatic growth, you don't realize the scientific studies that have been done,
yeah,
you know, behind it. And everything that we talk about, too, which is what I really liked about this program, too, is everything is science-based.
Yeah.
Even the practices that we do, it's all science-based.
Yeah.
I didn't think this stuff up. I was a canine handler for too long. I'm not smart enough to write the book on this. But it's all science-based stuff, which really reinforces, you know, the fact that this stuff can work.
Yeah.
But it also comes down to the bottom line, like with any help that you go to, is the individual themselves. You have to do the work. I always say that if you choose to go to a therapist, that's awesome if it's working for you. But when you leave that therapist, do you spend more time at the firehouse or at the police station or the barracks trying to hide the fact that you go to a therapist?
Yeah.
Or do you spend time really working on what the therapist tells you to work on?
Yeah.
If you're not going to do the work, you can go to a therapist 5 days a week for 5 hours a day, but you have to do the work.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the same thing comes down to the struggle well training. We can give you the roadmap. We can give you practices and things to do. If you choose not to do the work, then you may remain stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. And I think that as we see this sort of cultural conversation develop and we see stigma reduced, that's where we're really going to see that growth, right? Like when you talk about the wellness triangle and overall wellness, I think that generally first responders, when they, you know, either remain committed to it or make a commitment to their physical health, they take it serious, right? I'm going to get in good shape because that's important, because that's part of the job. And then what we have a problem saying, for reasons, like you said, you might lose half the room when you say mental health and wellness, right? For like reasons that totally make sense. And we don't want to talk about that part. And once people embrace that part, and when they make a commitment to it, they bring it back to the firehouse, to the police station, to their homes. I think that we're going to see a real change in culture like we've never seen before.
Yeah.
I think it's coming.
I think you're already starting to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, these, the classes that we put on, some people have voluntold to be there.
Yep.
Don't know what it is, don't know why they're there, not happy about it, but usually those are the ones that leave most satisfied, I guess, for lack of a better term, at the result of it.
Yeah.
It's a matter of a couple things, and you mentioned before, is number one, when you struggle, especially in our professions, man, we go to some messed up stuff, take control of it, I can handle this.
Yep.
So that's the first belief is, well, all right, yeah, I'm having a hard time, but I got this.
Yeah.
I can figure this out on my own. I don't need anybody's help anyway. I'm a first responder. I do this stuff. I got it.
Yep.
And reality is, one of the things when we talk about the framework, one of the most important parts is trust and connection. Forming trust and connection.
Yep.
I spent some time at different conferences with Dr. Tedeschi. We call him the godfather of post-traumatic growth. Great guy. And a lot of times at some of the conferences, the questions we would be asking is, how do we spread the information about Boulder Crest? How do we get, you know, the philanthropists to continue and things like that? Every question that was always asked with Dr. Tedeschi gave the same answer, and that was relationship and connection. In order for these things to happen, you need relationship and connection with people.
Yeah.
I've been able to share Struggle Well to the point where it's getting because I had connections at different agencies through my peer support role. That's what opened the door to it. I've had some leaders that have gone forward with it because I knew them before from different things. So if you really think about it, anything you need is trust and connection. But like you said, when you struggle, there's a couple things that happen. It's number one, I can handle this on my own. And it's also one of the most isolating things because when you handle it on your own, you're isolating. And there's a big difference between solitude and isolation.
Yeah.
Right? Solitude is a nice day out fishing on your boat, enjoying the sunshine, catching some fish. Isolation is, well, I'm doing this because I don't want to go to a family birthday party. Or I don't want to go to this or I don't want to go to that.
Yeah.
Or I took a detail because I didn't want to be with my family or with my friends or with my neighbor's cookout today.
Yes.
And I can say that openly because I know for a fact I'm not the only person that's ever done that.
Yeah, and that's what the families are noticing, right? Yeah. There's a change, there's a behavioral change in the person that you were before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes I think also that it prevents a first responder from going seeking help because they're like, wait, I'm going to fix myself first to get to where I was before I start feeling like this. And then I'll go and talk to someone. And it's really embracing where you are now. Right? Embrace where you are now. This is where you are. You're changed. And now let's work on it. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, feel better about where you are so you can start healing and growing from what your struggles.
Yeah.
You know
and,
what I mean?
And that's part of it. And that's a huge part of it is if you really think about, like I talk about self-reflecting in your own life.
Yeah.
Everyone has experienced probably growth at some point in their life.
Yeah.
You don't recognize it as the science of post-traumatic growth.
Right.
But when you take time and you self-reflect and realize that, geez, when I lost a loved one, I was really having a hard time with it. But yet, so-and-so was always with me by my side. They always helped me. I read this book. I listened to this podcast. I went to my church. I got a clinician. Those were things that helped you through it. So when you're in a struggle nowadays, why aren't you doing the same things?
Yeah.
Right? Because you have to self-reflect and realize when you go through a great day in your life, there's really not a lot of life lessons to be learned from great events.
Right.
I mean, they're good memories, but what lesson? But when you go through some tragic events, maybe the lesson is something you can do to prevent that from ever happening again to you.
So insightful.
Or to prevent it from someone else.
Yeah.
And look at the other side of the story, where the other side of the story is growth. And this science, without going too much into it, comes in from prisoners of war in Vietnam. We talked about that in the class of studies with them, of how they came out stronger on the other side when the government told their families when they were released from captivity, they expected them to be institutionalized.
Yeah.
But the total opposite happened.
Right. Yeah.
And that was based on the domains of post-traumatic growth, of what they reported to investigators that are still investigating it today of these psychologists, and Dr. Tedeschi worked with that, is that they've discovered that they grew. They have found new possibilities. Yeah. They had a personal strength they never had before.
Yeah.
These are all things that happen as a result of bad experiences.
Yeah.
So there is value in it, but you have to take the time to really look through and try to find that value.
Yeah.
And the opposite can happen. Like last time we were struggling, well, Jack Daniels was your best friend, but then I got divorced because of Jack Daniels and this and that, so maybe I needed a new friend when I go through this again.
Yeah.
Right? Self-reflection is a big part of it.
Yes.
The growth doesn't just occur with famous people and well-known incidents. Growth occurs on a regular basis in people's lives. But what was founded with this training is what they came up with when they learned of the science of post-traumatic growth and asking Dr. Tedeschi, have you ever tried to train people in it? And that's where they were discussing the, you know, with the military, because that's what they work with, the prisoners of war in Vietnam, and then came up with a training method because first responders, that's all we do is train.
Right.
So why can't we train people in this? And that's what it is now. It's a training on how to work towards achieving post-traumatic growth.
Yeah,
and that's what you're doing. Yeah, it's incredible.
Absolutely. And you learn, how do you actually learn, you know, over time, wow, I am a strong person. You know,
yeah,
I am strong. Wow, I am, you know, a stronger person. I know I have benefited from my own struggles, right? And come out the other side knowing that I'm stronger. I never realized how much of a strong person I was, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, losing Alex and then sort of being able to navigate that. Within 11 months, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And then 2 weeks after going through surgery, I was called home to tell in Ireland to say, Dad has been put on palliative care. You need to come home. Yeah. I made a home for his funeral. And that was all in 1 year, you know.
You can't avoid it.
No, you can't avoid it. But you can learn how to grow from it.
Exactly.
And realize, hey, you know, I have a purpose now. I can learn from this, and what can I do to help others? And I can struggle, or I can struggle well. Yeah. Right? And that's sort of where I've chosen to lead my path. And I feel better for it.
Yeah, you know? And you're following the phases, which we go through, of education, regulation of the practices, educating yourself.
Yes.
Right? Disclosure, you both have talked today, and we've talked a bit about you have to talk about the stuff in order to empty out those rocks in the backpack.
Yeah, you do.
Talk about them, and they lose their strength over you.
Yeah. Right?
Until you talk about it, and I'm not talking, you know, over the PA in the parking lot somewhere.
Yeah.
That's where you find the trust and connection.
Yes.
We talk about a 3 to 5. You're the average of the 3 to 5 people you spend your most time with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you also need 3 to 5 people in your life that you can lean into during a hard time.
Yeah.
But also they might call you out on your shit when you're leading, when you're heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So, you know, disclosure is important. stories, writing your new story, and then serving others, which is what the both of you are doing with this podcast.
Yeah, just
serving the community with the things that you've learned and educated and done, and that's all part of it is service-oriented professions, we serve people.
Yeah, and just sort of grown from that. I mean, yes, this is also being part of healing for me. Every interview you do, and I listen, and I hear, and I absorb, and I take in, there's so much growth in that for me on the other side, which then I can take in to helping other people too. So it's all wonderful. So where are you going from here? I mean, as if someone, I know you're saying we don't want to advertise because we're left to grow so big, but if a department reached out to you and said, we would like to send some of our guys, or we would like you to come in and train our department. I mean, I know we have a lot of chiefs listening. So share with us, like how they can do that.
Sure. First, what I'll do is, I don't know if you can put it on with your podcast, is give you Nancy's email address.
Yeah.
If there's departments that have people that want to go to a training, we have 2 fairly large agencies right now that are sponsoring multiple trainings, and they've opened them up to outside of their agency.
Okay.
So they're regional. They're based out of the agency, but allowing anyone in when we have room for them.
Yeah.
So that would be number one. If there's a leader of an agency or admin that wants to learn more about it for their own agency, then I give you my email as well and have them reach out to me and we can talk about it.
Okay.
I'm not saying we don't advertise. Right now, we're just trying to build up a bit. Summer's coming where most agencies don't have the ability to send a lot of people to training because of vacations and stuff.
Yeah.
But we are already booking classes into next fall and winter with agencies. So we could definitely fit some stuff in.
Okay.
And if there's individuals, you know, they could go to anyone. And the other thing too is this training is not necessarily just everyone struggles. So you don't have to pick the person in the lowest point in your department and send them, although it'll benefit them. You can send everyone. And that's what a lot of agencies have been doing is sending multiple people. We've had a regional one, which was based out of the Bridgewater area, where the department sent everyone from their agencies, went through, including the command staff as well.
Wow. That's awesome.
And with a lot of agencies, too, now we're just starting to work on getting it into the academies. Why are we waiting until the, like, I mean, the other thing, too, in the academies, let's be honest, as soon as you get out of the academy, your first FTO or whoever it is you work with is usually going to tell you the same thing. Forget all that stuff you learned. I'm going to teach you how to do the job now.
Yeah.
We want the first phase to be in the academy, the second phase to be the FTOs. Have them on the same page, frontline supervisors, same thing. And like I said, kind of saturate it from the top up and bottom down to meet in the middle.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
A lot of people in the bottom don't realize that the people at the top have the same struggles, and more so because they're dealing with other admin things and politicians and things they don't have to deal with. And the people at the top, sometimes you get so tied up in that, you forget what it was like when you were down.
As a
daily police officer, a firefighter.
So true.
The connection and trust and connection and relationship, like I said on that Friday, it works very well. The only way we're going to get connection is we're going to put you in the same room.
Yeah.
And have the opportunity to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And if you ever have the opportunity on those Fridays, it's amazing. It's really, it's pretty wild what takes place. It's eye-opening to both ends of the spectrum.
Wow, I absolutely love this. So we can put out all that information on the podcast,
of course,
notes. Perfect. But Rob, no, we really appreciate you coming in. We know how busy you are, doing what you do. As you said, you're not even sort of doing classes anymore because you're so busy with meetings and planning things and projections and all of that type of stuff.
Yeah, trying to build on it too.
Yeah, trying to build on it. But we really appreciate you coming in and talking to us. And I know that there's so many listeners going to be able to gain some insight from what you shared with us today and be also able to seek out Struggle Well. And if they're waiting on a class, you know, go get the book. Pick up a book. You can buy it on Amazon. That's what I did. And go on Amazon and pick up the book. I can guarantee it you won't be able to put it down. It's amazing.
Yeah. No, thank you very much for having me. A little weird doing a podcast, not going to lie, first time, but I think I did all right.
You did awesome.
In my world, I did.
You did awesome.
No, thank you very much, and thanks for sharing the stuff about Struggle Well. It was life-changing for me, still working on it. I'm a work in progress like we all are.
Yeah.
But this is through this training was the first time that I've run into people that have gone to the Struggle Well experience, which is another retreat-type program, or gone through the five-day, and I bump into them, and I don't recognize them physically.
Yeah.
You can actually see, and these are people that some of them I've known for a long time. So it's an amazing thing. And like I said, I credit AJ for being ahead of the eight ball when we talk about the education phase.
Yeah.
He was way ahead of me on that.
Okay. Yeah.
I was dealing and working with what I had in front of me at that moment in time.
Yeah.
He was looking for what's next. How do we get to prevent this stuff? He's tired of waiting around for it and realizing, more importantly, that there's growth instead of a life of diminishment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned with PTSD. That becomes a patch you wear in your sleeve for your whole life, and sometimes you become identified, and some people use it as an excuse for bad behavior.
Sure.
And it doesn't have to be that way. There are things that you can do to grow, thrive, and then share that with other people so that they're not struggling to the point that maybe you were before.
Yeah.
And I truly feel this training can really help a lot of people do that.
Yeah. Very well said, man.
I'm sure of it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Especially when people bring those tools out of the classroom and they start applying it to their lens for life, right? It changes your whole perspective, the way that you look at the world. So, I hope some of our listeners end up reaching out and benefiting from this program.
Perspective is the key word, Jay. You nailed it with that. That's what a lot of it has to do with, is get you to the ability to be able to change our perspective, because we're so blinders on.
Yeah.
Yes.
And once you see a little bit of outside what's going on in the outside world and realize, oh, wait a minute, I can do this stuff too.
Yeah, it's sort of like a conditioning, right? You're conditioned. You've been conditioned from your culture. You've been conditioned from how your parents brought you up, right? Living out there, all of that. And it's sort of like breaking down that conditioning and starting to learn how to grow, right, as a person, as an individual.
Yeah. And the training we get works phenomenal at work.
Yeah.
Doesn't work that good when we bring it home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then eventually it becomes the automatic reaction. When things get difficult, you start looking for the purpose, for the lesson. Like you said, I've never been laying on the beach with getting lotion rubbed on me and learned some new shit.
No.
Right? Like, now I understand geometry.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. And when you begin to look at life like, oh, no, those are the rewards. A walk on the beach with a good friend. And you end up being more present in those moments. And when things get difficult, it's not, oh, my God. It's, all right, how do I grow from this? And that becomes sort of part of a natural process rather than tension, anxiety, if you keep letting it spectrum out, nightmares, drinking yourself to sleep, and all of that. So I
and
really
growth
subscribe
of,
to this thought model.
Yeah, and growth instead of coping.
Yes.
That to me is the biggest one, is growth.
That's right. Is
really trying to find growth. The current mental health system is really designed to make you comfortable, but it's designed to make you comfortable where you are right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're in a bad place right now, you're going to stay there, but maybe medication will keep you comfortable. When we know through this science that growth is an opportunity. You don't have to stay where you are. You can grow as a result.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's what we're trying to get across to people, especially first responders, military. Like I said, super strong people, done amazing things.
Yeah.
You can work on yourself as hard as the energy and effort that you put into the community.
Yeah. Just need to straighten out that compass and get the tools.
Exactly. Awesome.
Wow. Wow. Absolutely amazing. Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you guys very much.
We appreciate it.
Rob took us on a journey of his career as a police officer and how that evolved into starting a peer support team with SEMLEC. It was during that time that Rob and his friend AJ, who was also a fellow SEMLEC team member, were introduced to the Boulder Crest Foundation and the Struggle Well program, both of which were developed with first responders in mind. This is where a new chapter began for Rob. Struggle Well is an amazing overall wellness program. Myself and Linda had the opportunity to attend the two-day training, and we both felt that the practices we left with could be implemented into our daily routines to our benefit immediately. There will always be challenges that come into our lives, but we can learn how to work through them and to learn from them in a positive way. We highly recommend every first responder attend a Struggle Well class. It will benefit you, your family, and your department. If you want to know more about Boulder Crest or Struggle Well, you can go to www.bouldercrest.org.
for Massachusetts-based first responders that are interested in upcoming trainings in your area, you can reach out to Nancy Liedberg at bouldercrest.org. That website and email address are also included in this episode's description. If you are a first responder who's struggling now and you don't know where to begin, you can reach out to one of the Hope Lines and we'll guide you to helpful resources. Those numbers are 781-817-3357 or 617-657-9108.
Till next time.
Till next time.